Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. The gates of Downton Abbey finally closed, and we ask, should they ever be reopened? Film director Tygo Sullivan talks to me about his poetic new movie, The Swallow, starring Brenda Fricker, that has some serious real-world parallels for the Oscar winner. Plus, all the TV you'll want to stream or skip for the week ahead. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. There was an ad for Sky about 12 years ago that featured George Hook, formerly of this station and indeed other places. And there was a famous line from it. You may remember where he said, "I've fallen in love with a piece of technology." And that was going around in my head this week, not because of Sky, even though I was watching a great show on Sky, but because I too have fallen in love with a piece of technology. Of what do I speak, dear listener? Well, I'm doing the Dublin Marathon this year. How do you know someone's doing a marathon? Because they tell you. I've done a few in my time. I did it 2 years ago when the wheels kind of came off and I had a bit of a disaster. So I'm back to slay the demons in my head. So I've signed up for the Dublin Marathon. I'm deep in the training at the moment. But where am I going with all this technology thing? I have this running app. I won't name it, but there are plenty of them around. And it sets, you pay, gives you a monthly plan and sets out targets, pacing, all that kind of boring running stuff. But it's a great one and it really keeps you going. But the fascinating thing is it's AI generated, as a lot of things are now. And there is a voice that talks to you when you're running. And in my case, it happens to be this American sounding woman who says, "Speed up, John, slow down, crushing it, John. Well done." And I'm literally hearing her, even when she's not around. So this AI-generated voice that I hear when I'm running is seemingly with me all the time now. But it's a great piece of kit. Anyway, that's what's been occupying me this week outside of movies and TV. So, talking of TV, I started a great show this week.
How does a priest end up working for the FBI?
I was a volunteer in their crisis intervention team. They'd fly clergy out with them when they went to mass casualty events, Columbine, Oklahoma City. So that's where I met my supervisor, Kathleen. And when I left the priesthood and married my wife, she pulled some strings and got me into Quantico.
What were they expecting a priest to do at these mass casualty events? Sprinkle some holy water or?
Counsel, yeah. When things go terribly wrong, people want to know why God let it happen.
That was the great Mark Ruffalo there in a new series called Task, which is on Sky, also on Now TV. It's dropping weekly. This is from the man who gave us Mayor of Easttown, which is one of the best shows of recent years, Brad Inglesby. And in this, Mark Ruffalo plays an FBI agent who, you heard there, began life as a priest. He then left the priesthood and became a proper FBI agent. Then there's been some serious tragedy in his life and he stopped, in essence, being in the field, but he's now back in. And the reason why he's back in is because the FBI and the cops have come across a strange thing that's happening where drug dealers are being robbed. There's a gang robbing drug dealers, a kind of vaguely Robin Hood style of gang, and one guy in particular. And Mark Ruffalo is called back to the office, basically, and he's given a task force. You heard one of them there. They're kind of a motley crew of slow horses vibe of, you know, people who possibly want to be somewhere else. But he is over this task force who are sent to investigate this drug takedown that's going on. And there's a great Irish actress in it, Alison Oliver, a great Irish actress who you might know from Conversations with Friends, plays one of his task team. And what's great about this is Mark Ruffalo is kind of, you can't go into too much, but his wife has died. That's apparent from the beginning. And he's a man grieving and he's drinking far too much. and he's putting his head in ice every morning. Yet at the same time, he's a very likable kind of guy. He has this priestly vibe to him. He has this calm vibe to him, as well as being on the edge. And set up against that is this guy who's taking down these drug gangs, who has his own tragedy, who's also recently become a single father. And they're kind of circling each other, and they get closer to each other. The gang that's been stolen from is a biker gang called the Dark Hearts. But it's a great watch so far, because it's very Mayor of Easttowny. You have a brilliant central performance from Mark Ruffalo, like you had with Kate Winslet. It's set in Philadelphia, I think it is, so it's not New York or California or anything like that. The drama is brilliant in it. There's kind of philosophy in it, you know, about morality and robbing good guys and robbing bad guys. And there's all sorts of things I can't get into because it's spoiler ridden. But let's just say the good guy and the bad guy in this have serious family drama going on. So Task, now streaming on Sky, is brilliant so far. Now, it's dropping weekly. There's only one episode up there. I've seen the first 4.5. I was talking to Pat Kenny about it this week, and I was telling him to get on it, which he will do as soon as time allows him to do so. But Task on Sky, brilliant watch, and I can't wait to finish it. I'm 4 or 5 episodes in now, and it's hypnotic. Some people are saying it's slow, and I really don't get that, because to me, it's unturnawayable, if you know what I mean. Now, what also returned this week was the beloved series on Disney Plus, Only Murders in the Building. We've talked about this many times. It's back for its 5th season. Martin Short, Steve Martin, and Selena Gomez play 3 friends in a building in New York called the Arconia, where murders keep happening, and they solve the murders, and they also do an ancillary podcast about the murders called Murders in the Building, or Only Murders in the Building. That's the podcast they're doing. I've raved about this show over the years. It has serious guest star power, and everyone from Sting to Paul Rudd to Meryl Streep is in it. Now, there is a case to be made for diminishing returns, and maybe the 3rd and 4th season weren't as strong as the first 2. And, you know, when a show goes on this long, there is talk of, is it time to knock it on the head? The thing is, I really enjoy the 5th one so far. I've seen 5 episodes as it happened. It's only dropping weekly, but I managed to get a few screeners. And we are set up again that at the end of season 4, the doorman, Lester, died. And in this one, they're investigating that. And there's all sorts of stuff going on. Tech billionaires, the mafia. We have some great new, not cameos, they're in it. Diane Wiest, brilliant actress. Christoph Waltz is in there. The story that they're doing in this one, investigating Lester's murder, the doorman's murder, it just seems to rattle along quite quickly. And what I'm slowly starting to think, watching Only Murders in the Building, is that Martin Short may be the best comedic actor in the world. I know that's a bold statement, but he is absolutely terrific in it. He really is. So I don't think this show is, based on season 5, is showing any signs of waning. And Selena Gomez and Steve Martin are terrific in it as well. And T. Leone makes an appearance as a gangster's wife in this and is very good in it as well. So far, I think Only Murders in the Building is great. Some people are saying it's time to, you know, call a halt, because how many murders can you have in one building? But park that, and I'll think you'll find this very enjoyable if you're a fan of Only Murders in the Building. And if you're not, give it a go. Start it. You can't dip in to the 5th season. You'll have to start from the beginning. But it's all the previous 4 seasons are there. And as I say, Only Murders in the Building is on Disney Plus, and it's dropping weekly, and the return is getting a big thumbs up from me. Now, something very different is on Netflix.
Just got terminated by Warner Brothers.
My phone's going crazy.
I know, so is mine. This is a really good one. This guy says, any words for Warner Brothers? I said, see you at Fort Knox. That's the only place with enough gold to pay off your treasonous ways. Winner!
Fired. Fired.
Congratulations.
Give it up.
Congratulations.
That show, man. That show was totally beneath me the whole time I was there. They never understood the genius they had. They abused it and then dismissed it, and now they're going to lose. Because they're not winning.
by the studio telling him no, I think that took his addiction to a higher level. And he's just like, well, okay, I'll show them.
Now, that was the voice of Charlie Sheen primarily there. And then you heard his best friend talking about his addictions. Charlie Sheen, when he was fired from Two and a Half Men. This is a new documentary on Netflix all about the very troubled star he certainly was for a large part of his career. It's called AKA Charlie Sheen. It's a two-parter. I think it's probably the guts of 4.5 hours. I've watched it all. The first thing to say is, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, Hollywood lives, live to the extreme, debauchery. Charlie Sheen is up there of maybe the most debauched Hollywood life you've ever seen, from drugs, prostitution. He wasn't a prostitute, but he famously used the services of prostitutes, and it was a big case in the 90s. He contracted HIV. What this documentary shows is a lot of these scandals. It also charts his career, and there's some very interesting stuff in here about his early career. He's famously the son of Mark, brother of Emilio Estevez. He was on set of Apocalypse Now. We talked about that a couple of months ago. It's possibly the craziest set ever. And his dad was boozed up. Not a good thing for an 11-year-old to be in the Philippines watching Apocalypse Now getting made. The clues in the title. We learn about his rise to fame in Ferris Bueller, that he had this tiny little part in it and there was just something John Hughes was taken with and everyone was, and he became this massive star in things like Platoon and Wall Street. So you probably know all that. What you might not know is some of the tawdry details, like losing his virginity at 15 to a prostitute. There are all sorts of people in here talking. His co-star in Two and a Half Men, John Cryer, some of his ex-wives, Denise Richards and Brooke Muller. His father and one of his brothers, Emilio, refused to talk. They politely declined by all accounts, but they didn't want to be part of this. This documentary is warts and all, I suppose, and it probably celebrates in the scandals and thrives in them. And there are a lot of scandals. I mean, he had been to rehab in the first part of his career and had really suffered from addiction. But then, you know, into the noughties with Two and a Half Men, and he discovers crack. The level of abuse he puts himself through is tawdry and horrific. That said, there's some stuff left out. I mean, there are definitely domestic abuse issues here. Some of his previous wives allude to this. Guns. And he skirts over them a bit too much. There's also horrible and restraining orders. There's also accusations of exposing partners to HIV. Now, Charlie Sheen is in this and he's, you know, very pleasant and self-effacing company, and you nearly feel he's playing Charlie Sheen. But I guess I couldn't take my eyes off this, but I felt a bit, I'm not sure about this afterwards, because he doesn't seem as apologetic as maybe as he should be. And some of the darker stuff is maybe glossed over a little bit. That said, I know I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth. You'll find it hard to turn away from this because his life for a large part was a car crash. And maybe you're just left with a slightly uneasy feeling that you're kind of reveling in this car crash, and there was other people who got even more hurt than he did. So it's an interesting, troubling watch, aka Charlie Sheen. Certainly asks some questions of him and the audience, but I'd be curious to see what you make of it. It's two parts. It's up there, aka Charlie Sheen, now streaming on Netflix. After the break, we turn to the big cinema release of the week. And of course, it's Downton Abbey. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, it is the big movie event of the week. Some would say of the year, of a particular persuasion. Downton Abbey is back, possibly, or so they're claiming, for the last time in Downton Abbey, the grand finale. I got to see it early in the week, but more importantly, so did film critic and arts reporter Cara O'Doherty, who makes her maiden voyage on Screen Time. I don't know why I'm using a nautical analogy. Perhaps that'll become clear. Cara, hello.
Hello, how are you? And I think that intro suits Downton Abbey. It has a grand sense about itself. So that works.
Well, thank you. We're off to a great start. You're already complimenting the intro. What could possibly go wrong? Is it, I think I know this, but you're a Downton fan, right?
Yes, from day one, I have always loved Downton, especially on Sunday nights when a cold wintry evening and the luscious, wonderful world of Downton would spring on TV. And the weird thing that I loved is the fact that not that much actually happened. You would have a crisis about a dress or a missing candlestick, and it was all very dramatic, but it was tied neatly with a bow at the end. And it was quite nice to have this sort of sumptuous break from reality. But then Julian Fellowes did throw in the occasional gut-wrenching moment when he would kill a prominent character. So, you know, you'd have kind of 7 weeks of peace and lovely balls, and then tears and devastation, and then back to ball gowns and fancy dining again. So it's a nice escape from the real world.
Yes, and indeed this the TV show went on for 6 seasons, I think, and then this is the third film, right?
52 episodes, 6 Christmas specials, and yes, wow. This is the third and supposedly final film, which I don't believe, but we'll ignore that for now.
Okay, so what top line, what's going on in this one? Like, there's a sense, you know, even in the title, this is an elegy. Something is ending. What's ending?
Well, it's 1930 for a start, and the era of the great house and the great families is starting to tumble, mostly because these grand houses are starting to crumble and the families can't afford the upkeep. So we start on a bad note. The family, when I say they're low on money, they're not like you and I now. They still have fine pots of it, but not quite enough to keep this grand house on the go. So, but they're still doing well. The Earl of Grantham, Hugh Bonneville, and the Countess, Elizabeth McGovern, they head off to London. It's the high season, and they have their two daughters with them, Lady Edith, Laura Carmichael, and Lady Mary, Michelle Dockery. And they head off to the West End and they have a fabulous night. And then they make a mistake. They go to an annual ball, one of the finest of the season. And the mistake is that Lady Mary, shockingly, has just gotten divorced, didn't tell her family, and now has the, as it is back in the day, the gall to attend a very fine party in which members of the royal family are going to attend. And it's 1930. The royal family cannot be subjected to what is now a fallen woman. Mm. So all hell breaks loose, and Lady Mary has to flee from this party before the royals get this awful shock of being seen in her presence. So we open on a tone of dismay for the family.
Yeah, and then we also have Paul Giamatti, who's Lady Grantham's brother, and he shows up with this guy Gus, played by Alessandro Novello, who people might know from The Many Saints of Newark and things like that. And this enters another dimension to it.
Yeah, so Harold arrives with this guest. He doesn't really explain why at the start. This man is a financial advisor, so again, we know there is trouble afoot. The Lady Grantham, or sorry, Countess, I should say, the Countess has lost her mother, and the brother Harold was supposed to be managing the inheritance. But it's 1930, which means it's the year after the Wall Street crash, and he has lost most of that money. Now, the big problem for this is they were relying on this inheritance to do the necessary repairs on Downton to keep the house and keep the upkeep going. So now they're really in a pickle, and they are told that Gus, this financial advisor, will be able to help them. But he's very mysterious and we're not quite sure, and I won't say too much, but he has the look of somebody who's up to something.
Yeah. And then, of course, rounding out all that, we have the help, the servants, who, unlike 1930s England, are very close to the people they look after. But in terms of the upstairs, downstairs, Miss Patmore is getting ready to retire. So's Carson, played by the great Jim Carson. Joanne Froggatt, who's Lady Mary's handmaid or whatever, is due to have a baby. So there's still plenty of action going on downstairs as well.
There is, and it's very funny because Mrs. Patmore, the cook, is actually looking forward to her retirement, whereas Carson cannot handle the idea of leaving Downton and doesn't trust the new butler to brush the floor, let alone dress the grand lords of the house. So while one of them is skipping out the door, the other won't leave the house alone. And yes, beloved Anna, we all need an Anna in our life. Yeah. She has taken care of Lady Mary since day one. And I'm not ashamed to say that I would quite happily have somebody come and dress me every morning and pick up my outfits and make my bed and brush my hair for me. So there's one thing that I think we should take from this film is that, can we go back to 1930 and give us all an Anna, please?
It wasn't all bad in 1930. And of course, the one other, it sounds like there's loads in this movie. It's not quite as stuffed as perhaps I'm making it sound, but we do have a kind of, well, not mythical. There's someone playing Noel Coward, and Dominic West is back as well. So there's this theatre dimension to it,
which is great fun. Artie Frenchman does a brilliant Noel Coward. Because of Mary's divorce, nobody will come to the house anymore. The family think they'll throw a big party and she'll get a redemption, but it doesn't work. The neighbours all say no. Ghastly idea of being in a house with a fallen woman. So they come up with this grand idea, invite Noel Coward. There's no way that people will miss out on opportunity and dining with him. Mm. And he plays him brilliantly. I mean, we've seen Noel Coward portrayed several times now, but I think Artie Frauchman has the other actors beaten now.
Yeah, he does a terrific job in it. Okay, right, so that's a very good explanation of what's going on, more or less. So how did you find it, Cara?
I really enjoyed it. I think the thing is, this could be very cheesy and very schmaltzy as they tie up everyone's characters, but they've got the perfect balance between entertaining and yet there are some more serious moments. I mean, the Earl of Grantham, Hugh Bonneville, he's very stressed about giving up his reins and what it means for the potential for these great houses. So, you know, he's having his serious moment. And as it balances out, there's also this lovely, the great Dame Maggie Smith, her character, Violet, who was so important in previous outings. She died in the last film. And obviously since then, Dame Maggie has also died. So there's a tribute to her. And she kind of, she's almost like a kind of this lovely shadow over all of their stories. So it's a very lovely tribute to her. And I think it's really well done. And one of the things that's always been so lovely about Downton is the costumes, it's the settings, it's the cars. And if ever, I think they've elevated that. So, I mean, some people will just watch this entirely for the Goonies. And I think that is okay.
You know, you mentioned Dame Maggie Smith and how she's over the thing. I noticed for the Downton fans, some pleasing Easter eggs in there, like Lady Mary refers to a weekend. And at one point, Lord Grantham says, if your grandmother could hear you now, she'd think it was awful, because she famously said, "What's a weekend?" So there is some nice knowing things in there for the fans, I thought.
Some lovely moments. And the good thing is it's not overloaded. So if you haven't watched the show, if you haven't seen the other films, you really don't need to. But there's clever little moments. There's a great line in there. I'm not going to say more, but there's a reference to a Turkish person, which is a great Easter egg for people who've been there since day one. So they've balanced that well, because there is a tendency to overload Easter eggs. But they have just enough there to keep us nicely entertained.
Yes, the right amount of Easter eggs. Never happens in my house, but that's a different story. Now, tell me this. One thing and you're really struck by it every time it hits the big screen, and, you know, some people don't buy it or whatever, but everyone, particularly in this one, in terms of acting, is on fire. Like, they are great. Like, Paul Giamatti's brilliant. Hugh Bonneville, always reliable. Jim Carter is Carson. Like, there's no questioning these people suit these roles perfectly, I think. Not to put words in your mouth, but there isn't a bad acting step in it, I don't think.
Not a one. And I think, again, one of the things they do well is that there are a lot of characters. It is an ensemble piece, but it never really feels overloaded. Everybody just gets enough to do that they're not encroaching on anyone else's time. But I mean, you're absolutely right there. Everybody is spot on. And even Lady Edith, Laura Carmichael, a character who was a little bit dislikable at the start, but over the years she changed, and she's fantastic in it, because she's got that kind of a wiser sense than she had in the early days, that balances some of Lady Mary's I won't say wilder ways, but less 1930s appropriate ladylike ways, shall we say.
Yes, indeed. Now, I was telling you beforehand, if you were on a normal radio show, you'd be allowed to talk and the host wouldn't give his opinion. But that's not possible here, given the confines of my ego. But no, I just wanted to tell you, see, I've always been a fan of Downton Abbey, but I do get that viewed from a certain perspective, it is kind of daft, you know, this idea of, you know, butlers and the people they look after all getting on so jolly well. And it can be, you know, quite melodramatic and all. But to my mind, it's the right side of daft. Like, if you park that, this is still incredibly enjoyable. And I kind of had a smile my whole way watching this. It's kind of like a warm bath. Like, I don't think it's the best thing since sliced bread, but as a piece of, like, delightful escapism, I thought it worked wonderfully. That's my take on it. But if you were going to give a star rating, what would it be for Downton Abbey, the grand finale?
I am going to go with a full 4 stars for this one. I really think they got the balance perfect. It looks fantastic. And like you said, everybody gives the best performance. It's really enjoyable. And yeah, I also smiled. And for people who I thought maybe there might be some emotional moments in it, and I was like, don't cry at Downton Abbey. Do not make a show of yourself. But there is a little moment towards the end. And I think true fans, possibly not yourself there now, John, I can't imagine you shed a tear, but there's a lovely moment late on where you might find yourself sniffling a little.
Well, I have seen every episode and every movie, and not just for work, because when it first started, I was in a whole different line of work. So I am a fan, and I came close. I'm not sure if it was full-blown tears, but certainly a welling up. And tell me this. So you're going to say 4 stars. I would say probably 3.5 stars, possibly 4, but I'm going to go with 3.5. But are you not believing that this is the end? I mean, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers, but, you know, they close the door slightly, but I suppose it's very much ajar.
I think it's one of those things that they're going to leave for a few years and we will see Downton the next generation. Give it maybe 10 okay. years, something like that. The Sybil, the youngest of the kids, Sybil's daughter, little Sibby, is now a teenager. So by the, and I think there are obviously a few smaller children as well, but give them 10 years. And I see Downton the next generation. We see them heading into the war years and how the house is managing. I really do think, and some of those actors, some of the beloved Downstairs actors, they haven't really done a huge amount outside of Downton. So I think they'll be very happy to come back later on. So I'd love to see, I can see Michelle Dockery as she goes along turning more and more into a Dame Maggie style of person. So I think it will come back, but I don't think it'll be anytime soon.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that into the war years, because in a way, I suppose, like The Crown, it could nearly chart the 20th century if they were so inclined, because it's that type of show that has followed loosely, you know, World War One, the Jazz Age, all that kind of stuff. So it could conceivably go on to the space race and unrest in London in the 70s, I guess.
We see all those documentaries, particularly on Channel 4, about the Great House revival and all these different things, and where these stately homes and what they're doing now. And like, there's like the Great Houses at Christmas, and we see the events they have to put on to try and pay the bills. So, I mean, there's a thirst for that kind of TV show. And I do think there is plenty of scope for this to go on and on.
Yeah, we could maybe see Lady Mary's grandchildren entering the Big Brother house or something like that. But anyway,
that would be going too far now. you're losing the run yourself now.
So that is Downton Abbey, the grand finale. Cara O'Doherty on her maiden voyage on Screen Time, giving it a healthy 4 stars. And I should mention it is in cinemas from this Friday, which is the 12th of September. Cara, thanks a million.
You're most welcome.
When you took charge, there were emperors in Moscow, Vienna and Berlin. And your parents were king and queen of this part of the county. But that world is gone now. It's a different place.
So everyone keeps saying.
And it's not different because we can get to Cape Town in a few days instead of half a year. We're changing too. The way we talk, the way we dress, the way we deal with each other. This is Mary's time. She's in step with how to run this estate in the 30s, the 40s and the 50s.
And I'm not.
You know this system doesn't work if people hold on too long.
Alan Leach and Hugh Bonneville there in Downton Abbey, the grand finale. And Cara O'Doherty gave it 4 stars. I gave it 3.5. It will certainly keep the Downton fans happy. And that's in cinemas from now, as we say. Up next, the director of The Swallow, which sees Brenda Fricker reflect on the life of an artist amid rising seas. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now I want to tell you about a movie that's opening in select cinemas on the 19th of September called The Swallow. We have an artist isolated from the world, but not from her memories, and she unpacks the remnants of a life long lived and tries to make sense of her own unwillingness to let go. In a small house by the sea, a woman begins a letter to, well, an unknown correspondent, surrounded by the books, mementos and clutter of her life. Her home exposed to the waves of a rising ocean, she writes about the history of lost art, considering what has been lost and wondering about her own desire to hold on. She meditates on memory and art's aspiration to immortality. I should mention the aforementioned woman is played brilliantly by Brenda Fricker. It was beautiful to look at, I have to say, and it was written and directed by an old friend of the show who we spoke to, I thought it was last year, but it turns out it's nearly 4 years ago, Tygo Sullivan, for his previous movie, All About the Moon, called To the Moon, and I'm delighted to say Tyg joins me now. Tyg, how are you?
I'm good, John. Thanks for having me on again. I can't believe it's been 4 years.
I know. I honestly thought it was last year, and time moves fast, which in a way dovetails into the subject of the movie. So I just have to ask about, you know, getting Brenda Fricker, because this is very much an intimate piece, and I don't want to give a spoiler, but it is pretty much her and her alone that you have your camera on in terms of people in it. And then, of course, there are beautiful shots of other things. But did you go to her and say, I have this idea for a kind of chamber piece by the sea, or did you write it and then go seek her out, or how did all that come about?
I wrote the film and was lucky enough to get it funded through the Arts Council, and hadn't cast it. I mean, I had a list of names of, there's a lot of wonderful older Irish actors, women, and I kind of had a list of them, people that I might approach. But I think then I saw that brilliant interview that Brenda did with Tommy Tiernan a couple of years ago, where she talks about just living on her own and the kind of the struggles and the ups and downs of a life lived in kind of a chosen semi-isolation. And just watching that, like, my partner Sarah just whacked me on the arm and pointed and said, you need her, which was the sort of the spark I needed, I suppose. So got in touch with Brenda via the kind of the internal network of film industry people, and the help of Maureen Hughes, the brilliant casting director, and just approached her. But she really liked what I was trying to do. You know, there wasn't a script as such. It was kind of a scenario and a lot of improvising, and it would rely heavily on a really excellent actor, you know, because when you've got nobody to bounce off, when you've got to, you're really relying on presence, and just general kind of charisma. And I think that's something that I was confident that Brenda could do. And I think Brenda really liked the idea of just being seen in that kind of a role, you know, because Brenda's played a lot of grannies and mothers and those kinds of roles. And this was something that was kind of unusual and interesting to her for that reason.
And the scenario that you presented to her, I mean, in terms of the idea for this movie, did it come about that you were musing someday, or you had this idea that of a person, an artist looking back on their life, writing to someone, and we don't know who that someone is?
It was more, I was interested in the subject. Like, I was really interested in the preservation of art in the face of climate change, for instance, and the politics of preservation. Like, why do we choose certain things as being, you know, valid to go into a museum, but not others? Like, we all have houses full of things that mean a huge amount to ourselves, but not necessarily to other people. That's kind of an interesting subject. And I thought maybe a documentary about that might be interesting. But then I thought, like, who cares what Tygo Sullivan has to say on this topic?
Come.
and it kind of, the kind of big creative leap was to imagine somebody for whom that subject was very urgent, you know. So if you take maybe an older person who's living by the sea, who is an artist, suddenly you've got a person for whom that is, that topic is very real and very lived. So that was kind of the starting point, was to create a scenario where somebody would think about that subject and really tease it out from a, you know, and living in the kind of teeth of it. And that just, we took it from there, you know.
And there are literally rising waters that we see, and this is oppressing her, or it's coming. But there's also intimations of complications in her past. So it's almost like a pathetic fallacy, if that's not too pretentious and leaving certainty a phrase, that, you know, there are struggles internally and externally, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think I live in North Clare. You get a lot of weather, you get a lot of sort of natural reality here. And it's hard not to feel that the weather and the climate and the sea and everything else is somehow part of your own psychological makeup and how your day may change. So having an amazing landscape in New Quay, Finnavarra, at the very tip of North Clare, to play with, was just this really brilliant canvas to kind of play off Brenda, almost like the other character in the film. There's no other character on screen. There's another character that she writes to and in her thoughts and memories. But the landscape, the sea, the mountains is kind of the other character for her. And it's amazingly well cast, if I can say that.
And, you know, maybe this is slightly pretentious, but I'm just wondering, whenever there's things like, you know, an unknown interlocutor or whatever, one can't help but think of Beckett, maybe. I wonder, was that in your thinking at all?
Yeah, maybe a bit of Beckett. I read a lot of Jan Foss, the Norwegian writer, later in the process when I was editing the film, and kind of felt like, maybe if I'd read this before, I mightn't have dared to make the film, because he does this kind of stuff so amazingly well. I don't think Beckett is too pretentious. I think a lot of people love Beckett, and Beckett really gets to the heart of humanity. And Beckett is very funny as well. There's a thing that I think if you show Beckett to anybody, they'll find some kind of recognition of the human condition in there. So maybe I'll take that as a compliment. Thanks.
Absolutely. So you should. And tell me this, you know, you mentioned the one character and the other one we don't see. Was it, you know, I don't mean intimate, but it must have been full on, because it's, you know, I know there's people around you, but it's one actress, it's one director. I mean, I don't know. Do you not get tired of each other, but it does it become oppressive? Because you're also dealing in this watery kind of space in this old house where we see her painting and or looking at paintings and remembering letters and looking at things from her past and at a fireplace and all. Like, there's a you were together a lot, I imagine.
Yeah, and we're still very, very close. Brenda Fricker is amazingly good company. And she and I did something at her suggestion very early in the process, where she said, "I'll tell you a secret, you tell me a secret, and we'll fast forward the kind of the relationship building process a little bit," because we had to get it to a point where we could really trust each other and know each other well. She was so up for that. She was really interested in giving herself to the project, giving herself to the ideas and to me. And so I think what you're describing, that oppressiveness and the challenges of that, would have been the case with somebody who wasn't so generous themselves and who wasn't so willing to give of themselves. As it was, you know, we really, really enjoyed the process. It was wonderful to work with her, and we've remained very close ever since.
That's a very interesting way to establish something. Let's tell each other a secret. You mentioned her being open in that way, and I've been reading, I haven't read it, but about her autobiography that's kind of just out around the same time as your film, and she's very open about, you know, some serious traumas in her life as well. She strikes me as someone, when you meet her, there is an utter openness in that, and I don't mean she doesn't care anymore, but she's lost all vestige of putting on an act, you feel.
It's not for me to speak for Brenda, But I think in certain circumstances, she doesn't really want to perform in kind of a public way. She's quite blunt. If she doesn't like something, and I think that's always been her way and her manner.
Yeah.
But I like that, you know.
Absolutely.
That I, you know, there's no messing around. And if you ask her to do something and she thinks it's daft, she'll tell you as much.
Yeah.
And when you've got a limited budget and a limited crew and you're trying to work fast, that's actually brilliant. It's a brilliant way to work because she has a wealth of experience that I can only dream of achieving someday if I live that long.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing to be able to draw on in any project.
Absolutely. Now, I mentioned To the Moon, some of your other movies as well, they all look beautiful and they're like visual poems. And I thought that particularly of this one. You know, is there going to be a time when you do, and I'm not saying you should, but a straight ahead narrative where man or woman wakes up and suffers some kind of crime, and then, like, you make very poetic movies where the narrative is free-flowing and up for debate nearly, and this is a classic example of that. You know, are you going to tell a straighter story down the line?
Oh, still waiting for the call from the Marvel people. Yeah. No, Jesus, like there's so many of those films being made. Like you open the newspaper or, you know, any day of the week and you'll find three or four of those movies. You sit down in front of the Everything in the World machine at 10 o'clock at night looking for something to watch and you find 52 of those films. I don't think I need to devote my time making a bad one of them. I kind of do what I like and what I think there's scope. You know, you use the word poetic. It's a word I like. There's an audience in Ireland there's a massive readership for books like the one that Brenda has written, which is a very literary memoir. There's a big readership for really excellent literature. And maybe what I do is I make films that kind of appeal to that audience as well as a cinema going audience. And there's room for that, you know, and if, you know, maybe somebody has to do it. So I'm happy doing that thing for another while more.
Well, very, very well said. And I think you should, because there is absolutely a place for your movies. Chief among them is The Swallow, which is in select cinemas from Friday, the 19th of September. I've been talking to its director, an old friend of the show, Tadhg O'Sullivan. Tadhg, the very best of luck with it.
Thanks so much, Sean. We'll see you again soon.
You wrote to me of ruins. You wrote to me of palaces and cathedrals. I wrote to you about my endless hours walking this ever-changing shore, watching the patterns and the play of light and the shapes of water. What I really wanted was to take some moment and slowly, carefully, make something lasting and beautiful of it, so that I could hold it out to someone, to you, so that I might live briefly, however briefly, in the light of your eyes.
A clip there from The Swallow. And before that, you heard me talking to its director, Tadhg O'Sullivan, and a poetic meditation that film is too. And you will see it in select cinemas from next week. That's Friday, the 19th of September. That is it for this week. Just a reminder, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Do get in touch with me at any stage. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. Or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. All emails are read and processed and greatly received. Going to leave you with a little music from the movies. This is a gorgeous song from the Pogues, used in the movie Blown Away. I think it's in a few other things as well. And this is the glorious and wistful Tuesday morning. So I will leave you with this and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.